Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is Britain after Queen Elizabeth. With me to discuss Britain's future with a new monarch and a new prime minister is Leslie Vingemurri. Leslie is a director of the U.S. and Americas program and dean of the Queen Elizabeth II Academy for Leadership in International Affairs at Chatham House. She has written widely and well on America's role in the world, U.S.-UK and European relations, and the future of the international order. She is co-editor with Charles Kupchan of Anchoring the World, and she had a piece in Foreign Affairs last month titled How Brexit and Boris Broke Britain. Leslie, thanks for the alliterative title and for joining me.
Thank you, Jim. It's great to be here. What a day it is.
Certainly is. And let's begin with the passing of Queen Elizabeth. She reigned over the United Kingdom for 70 years, one of the longest reigns in world history. How was the news of her passing greeted in Britain?
I think with tremendous sadness. People, of course, are well aware of her age. Everybody knew it was coming. Those who'd worked in the civil service had rehearsed and planned for her funeral for years. But it was an extraordinary moment. I mean, the sense of uncertainty, of deep sadness, the awe of it. It was hard to overstate. It's really a phenomenal moment. And still a very, very, very difficult one. Comes at a time of much broader uncertainty. And I think Queen Elizabeth had always been that person, that presence that signaled deep stability and moral certitude for the UK, but I think especially in the last 6 years since the referendum.
Tell me a little bit more about that, Leslie, because I think for most Americans, what you know of the British royal family or of the Queen comes from cover shots on news tabloids as you check out at the supermarket. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the Queen resonates or connected with people in Britain and elsewhere?
I mean, I think the most extraordinary thing, our new director at Chatham House, Bronwyn Maddox, tweeted, there are some people that saying that the Queen had met up to one third of Britain's people for a country that's at around, 65 million? That's extraordinary. And so I certainly felt it as an American, long time in London, just amazed at how present the Queen and, of course, the whole royal family are. If you work in the not-for-profit sector, they're patron of many of the charities, and they actively have a visible daily presence throughout the UK. So, I think it's true. When I was living in the US, I saw the royal family and the Queen as a sort of symbolic thing. But when your sort of daily life is in London and across the UK, the royal family really is part of the fabric. It's not something that's sort of distant. It feels very present. And that, I think, is why you saw so many people on the streets and watching the funeral yesterday.
What do you make of yesterday's funeral? Obviously, a great deal of tradition in history on display, but it was also remarkable how many world leaders came to London for the Queen's funeral, including President Joseph Biden. My understanding is at the passing of previous British dignitaries, previous British kings, American presidents didn't make their way to London, but in this case, Joe Biden did.
No, that's right. I just think this is a queen who's been there longer than anybody. It's difficult to imagine a major world event since the end of the Second World War. I mean, she's been there since 1952. Every single moment, it's not that she's been driving it, but she's been present, been visible, has met with most of the world leaders that will have attended, some of them on multiple occasions, has seen them through different phases of their own career while she has remained in one position. So I think just again, that sheer duration and the scale of her rule and the scale of change that's taken place while she had been queen, it's very difficult still to imagine her not being there when it's going to take a while to talk about her in the past tense. I think the funeral, I mean, there's nothing like the British to bring together that kind of ceremony, which wasn't only about yesterday. It was really the days leading up to it. It was the funeral itself. It was the procession afterwards. you know, the visibility of the nation really coming together, and the four nations, I think, was a real emphasis throughout.
By four nations, you mean England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland?
Exactly. I don't know here in America which coverage people were watching, but of course, I assume BBC World, but we were all watching BBC. You know, if you saw the images flashed across the screen of people gathering in Hyde Park, in Edinburgh, and in Northern Ireland, and just watching collectively, it was a really collective experience. People on the streets in London queuing, people who weren't queuing walked the length of the queue. I walked the length of the queue just to really come together. And I think it was that unity which was so palpable and which she always tried to instill in the country. I think one of the things that Brits always identify with the Queen is that speech that she gives on Christmas Day. It's almost like religion. Everybody would stop what they were doing and watch the Queen give her speech to the country.
I should just be clear, when you say queue, you mean a line. Queue here in the United States, certainly given recent events, has a whole different connotation.
That's right. Queue is a line. And it's a really it's a British art. Standing in the queue is it's very much a British art, and one that has very clear rules and you don't violate them. And it was run like that. You know, the wristbands, the color of the wristbands changed each day. They went on to ensure that people weren't, you know, hopping in and hopping out. But they did make some exceptions. My parents-in-law stood in the queue, and people who were older, who were clearly very deeply committed, I think they sort of moved them through a little bit more quickly. So there was a stability to the entire thing.
The funeral itself was obviously a personal moment for the Queen's family. It was a national moment for the people of the United Kingdom. It was a historical moment because of the lineage that she represents. But it was also a political or diplomatic moment. And I noted that a number of world leaders showed up. But one world leader who wasn't invited was Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Russian Foreign Ministry put out a press statement calling the decision not to invite Putin as deeply immoral. Any reactions in Britain to the Russian position?
None. The most extraordinary thing, and remember, you know, the Queen was there to stand above politics. The Queen was there to unite, to not be partisan, to really represent the state. And the thing that she did incredibly well, given, of course, that this was a woman, a queen, who met these leaders, who traveled, who received, who held so many ceremonies at Buckingham Palace and elsewhere. But she always remained above politics. And I think the thing that was extraordinary yesterday was that it really was not a political day. It was really a ceremonial day. It was a day of a nation mourning its beloved leader. That's what it was. And so you didn't really get the conversation about, you know, some people talked about the fact that President Biden was sitting at the back because he didn't come on the coach. He came in a car. But I think, you know, that it was important that somebody like Putin wasn't there. Can you imagine the divisiveness that would have injected into something that was really, really meant to be singularly focused on what it actually was?
Well, Leslie, obviously with the passing of Queen Elizabeth, Prince Charles is elevated and becomes King Charles III. What is the public's reaction to King Charles? How is he viewed?
Well, it's been a long time coming. I mean, and views of Charles and King Charles have changed dramatically from the moment surrounding Diana's death, where, of course, the failure of their marriage, his relationship with Camilla cast such a shadow over Charles. He was often, you know, in the shadow of his mother, the Queen, in the shadow of his wife when she was his wife, Lady Diana, who was so loved by the people. But that really changed over time. I think that people saw a prince, now a king, who stayed the course, who was there, who sort of endured the difficulties that he had personally. Attitudes about Camilla have changed. And I think when he spoke again after his mother's death, that there was a real outpouring of goodwill for him. I think at the moment, especially after the last 10 days, it's been a very marked, I can't stress enough, it wasn't just yesterday. It's been 10 days where there's a sense that the entire nation stood still and paused. There were no deep politics. And during that time, we've seen the new king travel the nation, speak to the people, meet with the people on the street. So at the moment, the attitude towards King Charles, towards the monarchy, I think is very strong. That's obviously a very specific moment. The polls suggest, YouGov has done polls that suggests that older people are much more supportive of a monarchy than younger people are. The same applies to King Charles. But I think there are some potentially some very difficult times ahead. And there's also a real question of whether he's going to now stand back from some of the things he cares about most, like climate and the environment, and play the role that the Queen did, or whether he's going to take more of a stand on those very pressing global challenges.
On that point, Leslie, is there any sense as to what King Charles's monarchy will look like? I mean, you've impressed upon us the Queen was the embodiment of the nation. She stood above politics. Is that kind of role sustainable for Charles? Has he indicated that he may go in a different direction and try to reinvent the monarchy?
I think many people see him perhaps as a transitional monarch. He's not a young person. He's already 75. He won't come anywhere close to what his mother had, the 70 years where she went from being a young woman to a very much not a young woman. He's coming in at a certain age, at a certain stage of life. The focus is really on William and Kate. There is, in one sense, you know, he's a transition from one generation to the next. We don't know how long that transition will last. There are lots of questions about whether he will try to modernize the monarchy in a series of small ways, whether he'll give different roles to members of the family. I think a series of small changes are certainly possible and plausible. But I think the other thing to really note about the monarchy is, I did say that the Queen sort of stood above it all, but the Queen at some level and the royal family, they're also, you know, part of the infrastructure of the state. There, the symbolism of the monarchy and the royal family, it's sort of embedded in everyday life and little things like, you know, I was having dinner with a friend who's a Queen's Counsel, a barrister, and, you know, the moment the Queen passed, he's suddenly a King's Counsel. And all of those sort of signages change, and it does affect. I mean, you suddenly wake up and you realize that you're in a country that has a king. It has a very different feeling. I do think that the gender question is significant. It's one that, you know, it'll be difficult to measure or assess. But I think it was only when the Queen died that many of us realized that there was something very significant about having a woman and having a queen.
Well, the Queen certainly took her responsibilities very seriously. She was working up until her death just 2 days before she passed. She appointed Liz Truss as the new prime minister. So let's talk a bit about Prime Minister Truss. Who is she?
Who is she? I mean, she's a fiercely determined prime minister now who's been committed to politics, been politically engaged for quite some time in one form or another, who famously people like to talk about now, the video clip of her speaking as a young woman at a school debate or some such, saying that she didn't really believe in the monarchy, that people, you know, it was nothing personal, but she didn't believe in the idea. Of course, that's gone viral in one sense. But she's sort of staked her claim now on being on sort of taking forward some parts of Boris's agenda, really putting forward the vision of an independent global Britain. She's very committed to a conservative philosophy of economics. She's big on tax cuts as a mechanism for growing the economy, something that people are deeply suspicious about. She's got a hint of the populist. She likes the comparisons that people make to Maggie Thatcher. But, you know, the thing we have to just keep reminding all of your listeners is this was an election that was very limited to members of the Conservative Party. She won about 81,000 votes in a country that has around 65 million people. So only a tiny number of people made the decision about her appointment as leader of the Conservative Party and therefore Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
So tell me how she won that race, Leslie, because again, it was an interesting process. She was up in a process that eventually winnowed the numerous candidates for the leadership of the Conservative Party and hence Prime Minister down to two. And she was running against Rishi Sunak, who had been the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And it was sort of his resignation that sort of pushed out or led to the events that culminated in Boris Johnson resigning as the head of the party and eventually as Prime Minister. Mr. Sunak, as I understood it, did much better than now Prime Minister Truss did in terms of the balloting among members of the House of Commons. It she apparently won relatively easily when it went to the broader vote among Conservative Party members. Why?
She did. I mean, the margins weren't as big as many people thought they would be. They were, what, around 20,000 votes? I mean, these are tiny numbers. This is the thing that I think one has to, you know, if you compare it to a U.S. presidential election, yes, we work through, you know, the Electoral College, but the numbers, you know, 81,000, 81 million, there's just no comparison, even with the different sizes of our countries. I think it's very difficult to discern, but there were all sorts of biases, perhaps amongst the larger Conservative Party membership against Rishi Sunak. Certainly the fact that, you know, Boris Johnson is so popular and Rishi Sunak had been the, as you just said, the person that resigned and helped drive for his downfall as prime minister. I think there are questions, you know, Rishi Sunak is very wealthy. That doesn't always go down very well, certainly not in the current moment where there's a, you know, a real discourse of populism and everyday people. The fact that Rishi Sunak is a very wealthy man who was educated at Stanford, none of those things, I think, necessarily played to his advantage. And, you know, Liz Truss, I guess, with the broader electorate, I don't think she was phenomenally popular either. I mean, it's sort of a choice of alternatives due to different politicking within the party. Different candidates were peeled away. You end up with not necessarily an obvious choice. But most of the polling did suggest that, you know, she was going to win this. But again, the margins were much, much smaller than people thought they might be.
So you've already mentioned some of the things that she wants to do, and we're going to get into that a bit more. But maybe you should walk us through what it is that she's inheriting. Where is Britain today? And again, I'll go back to your great foreign affairs piece. Again, the title is How Brexit and Boris Broke Britain. That's a pretty strong formulation. So how is Britain broke?
First of all, the brilliance of your editors. Authors never choose titles at Foreign Affairs. So the brilliance of your editors, I will confess I was mildly concerned about the title, although it's a good title.
It's a great title.
It's a great title. It's a great title. But, you know, I do have some reason to believe that Britain will come through, but it's going to be a tough, tough road ahead. After that fatal referendum, many of us saw as fatal because, of course, I, like so many others, were hoping that it would go the other way.
By referendum, you mean Brexit.
The Brexit referendum. There were choices to be made. And, you know, the big choice was, what does Brexit mean? The referendum was a really short, simple question that told people basically nothing about what Britain's relationship with Europe would be if it left the European Union. And Boris Johnson's really the person that drove through and created the popular sentiment behind having a very, very tough Brexit. And Liz Truss has gotten on board that vision. She was very close to the former prime minister, his foreign secretary most recently.
But she wasn't there originally. Originally, she was part of the Remainer camp, correct?
Yes. But remember that there was a day when Boris Johnson was part of the Remainer camp. So there's a lot of sense right now that we have a...
Her views evolve.
That is instrumental. That's been instrumental and, you know, motivated by some very personal political considerations. So I think that, you know, she's inherited a Britain that she helped to create, which is a Britain that's tried to execute on an agenda, which is about a very independent Britain with a very hard Brexit that's playing to a very small base within the Conservative Party that has a particular vision of Britain that, quite frankly, is going to be difficult to sustain economically and probably politically also. She's inheriting a country that is facing very low predicted rates of growth, that has very high inflation, and that's in a very, very difficult economic position, pretty much in the round, where growth, you know, is something that she's really going to have to focus on. And she's adopted an economic strategy, and this is what we saw throughout the campaign, that was all about tax cuts. In fact, you know, Rishi Sunak was the only person that initially kept saying, no, we can't cut taxes. We actually need to keep taxes high and potentially raise them. By the end of it, he'd given up on that line because it was so politically unsustainable. She's inherited a country that's, you know, the number one issue is clearly going to be the economy. She's got a very ideological view on what you do about the economy. She's making appointments that reflect that. She's firing people in ways that reflect that. And if you put that together with a sense that the hard Brexit view at, combined with a vision of a global Britain, which is what she's inherited and what she's also very much behind, that's a really tall measure. So what are the, you know, the two things that she's going to have to work out in addition to the economy? The big one is, you know, what is the relationship with Europe going to look like? And this is something that has been on top of the agenda since that referendum, and nobody has really managed to solve. And the second one is, what is Britain's relationship with the United States, which of course has been difficult.
Can you explain to us what Liz Truss means and Conservative Party members mean when they say global Britain? Is it anything more than a slogan?
I mean, nobody's really quite sure what it means. To be honest, I think it is a slogan. We saw the release of the Integrated Review during the pandemic, which was a very, you know, serious strategy document written by, you know, John Bew and others in the cabinet office under Boris Johnson's leadership, which did try to stake out what a foreign policy would look like that shone a spotlight on this vision of a global Britain. And it meant things like doubling down on Euro-Atlantic security, but also, and the thing that I think got so much attention in the press, was that tilt to the Indo-Pacific, which of course is the global piece, increasing defense spending. Liz Truss wants to do a lot more of that. So I think global Britain, you know, it was a slogan that seems to be now being staked out as being independent with strong partnerships, focusing much more on security, even at the global level, not really conceiving of Britain as a middle power, seeing it as a major player, as a serious driver of international strategy and security questions, and not being primarily about soft power. And I think, you know, for many people, that's been the disheartening part, the cuts to the development budget, the downgrading of the independence of what was DFID, the merger with the FCO. So we have the development part of Britain, you know, which used to be cabinet level agency, and having it merged with the Foreign Office. That was an intense battle, but it was, I think, part of that vision of creating a strategy where everything lined up behind the security vision. And the security vision was one in which the UK was meant to be, you know, out front and center, defining not really as sort of junior partner to the United States, but really as a leader. That, you know, in fact, the strategy looks like it's a bit of a junior partner to the US. But I think that what Boris wanted, what Liz Truss most definitely wants, is not to be seen to be obsequious when it comes, or sycophantic or subservient in the way that, you know, Theresa May was really seen to be when she made that fatal trip to visit President Trump.
So let's talk then about Britain's relations with the European Union. My sense is they're not terribly good. You have the whole question of how to make Brexit work and the issue of Northern Ireland and where the line gets drawn, whether it's the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland or in the middle of the Irish Sea. Any potential movement on that front under Prime Minister Truss?
You know, she's going to have to deal with this. There is the Northern Ireland bill that's been proposed that is supposed to be going through Parliament. It will undoubtedly generate more tension and pushback from the EU. She hasn't put a great step forward initially. You know, we remember the moment between she and Macron where she said, you know, she refused to commit to the idea that France was an important partner for the UK. So I think that that question of the relationship with Northern Ireland is going to continue to haunt Liz Truss and her leadership. She's going to try and, I think, push through this bill where you get, you know, a green lane and a red lane, right? Where you can differentiate between goods that are going from the mainland, so to speak, to Northern Ireland and staying there, and so therefore shouldn't have to be checked. And those that are, you know, not staying, they're going through to Ireland, and that becomes a different equation. It's a very complicated vision. There are certainly arguments for it, but it's unlikely to go down well with Europe. And, you know, this is where I think we all know if it doesn't, you know, she can't sort that out, it's just going to continue to create tension in that relationship between her and her government and the United Kingdom on the one hand and the United States. So I think she will tackle it, but that is certainly the area in which there's the greatest uncertainty. It also has some really, you know, negative spillover effects on, you know, the EU is going to have to decide what cards to play, what pressure points to push. And at a moment where, you know, there's been some signs of increased security cooperation between the UK and the EU on, you know, just getting in the same room and talking about Ukraine and talking about NATO, that's something where, you know, the UK has a vested interest in being in those conversations. It's been outside of too many of them since Brexit. And the whole thing kind of goes together. You know, you've got to get that relationship right. You've got to solve the Northern Ireland question, not only, and, you know, arguably most importantly for the Good Friday Agreements, for peace between Ireland and Northern Ireland, but really, you know, for that relationship that the UK has more broadly with the EU at a time when the EU is becoming a much more important security player.
Leslie, you get a chance to talk to a lot of European officials, a lot of people on the continent who write in this space. Do you get the sense that Britain really matters much to the leading countries in the European Union? And I ask that because when I was on the continent this summer chatting with people, I was surprised how infrequently Britain came up in the conversations. It was almost as if once Britain initiated the divorce, much of Europe has forgotten about London.
I mean, there is a palpable sense, and I feel it just like you. I feel it when I go to Europe, but I also feel it when I come to the United States, how much less often the UK features as a major point of the conversation. Even when you go through, you know, sort of online journals and magazines, there's sort of a section for Europe sometimes, and the UK is, it's not quite clear where it fits anymore. So there is a downgrading of attention. Part of that has been because Europe has had so much to contend with and deciding what it's going to do on all the big questions that have come to the surface during the war in Ukraine. Question of energy, question of security, of defense spending, all of those sorts of things have really preoccupied, and rightly so, Europe. And Britain's just not part of that conversation. So I think you're right that it's, you know, there's a sense of needing to have momentum, being at a moment of crisis, the stakes being tremendously high, and it's a distraction. And I think this is where, you know, the UK, this is the thing that just defies the imagination that given how strong the UK has been on questions of foreign policy, security, defense, given how vital this moment is, that there isn't clear decision to move past this moment to get a resolution on the big questions so that UK can be seen to be a really important player. I think that, you know, they know this. I think Liz Truss knows this. She has, you know, gotten on that plane immediately and gotten over to New York for the UNGA meetings. But politically, whether she can really make that happen, it remains to be seen.
And so where do you see US-UK relations going? Do you think the Biden administration is going to be drawn by inevitable dynamics to downplay the aid and support that the United Kingdom can give on any issue?
You know, it's a very strong relationship. It's got deep legs and many of them. It's a historic, multidimensional, multifaceted relationship that I think, you know, we should never understate the importance of that, whether it's on education, science, intelligence, defense, security, human rights, you know, any number of issues. So, I mean, I wouldn't want to pretend that it's going to wither away. But at the same time, you know, the UK's got to be seen to be important and relevant. And part of its relevance, as we all know, has always been being at the table in Europe and helping the US kind of figure out how to deal with the Europeans more effectively. And, you know, it can't play that role anymore. So it's going to have to figure out what else to do. But at the same time, in NATO, it's clearly, you know, the number one most important partner after the US. And if Liz Truss does what she says she wants to do, which is to increase defense spending to 3% of GDP, by I think it's 2030, that's significant. And that would make the UK a very important, you know, it would sustain its role and increase its role as a very important partner to be reckoned with in Europe, if not within the European Union. But it's got to get a seat at the table. You know, it's not at the US Trade and Technology Council that it has with the European Union. It's not clear how long it's or in what way its access to the EU meetings is going to be on security questions. So it's really got to sort those things out to make itself relevant, or it will start to get in the way of that relationship with the US.
And it certainly doesn't seem like the Biden administration is eager to pursue a US-UK free trade agreement, which is one of the things that people who promoted Brexit leaving argued that Britain would be freed up to do once it escaped the clutches of all the rules and regulations foisted upon it by Brussels.
Oh, Jim, it was the only thing that anybody ever wanted to talk about. Every single news media conversation was, when will there be a US-UK free trade deal? Throughout Donald Trump's presidency, it was really, it took up all the airspace. And then suddenly it disappeared. And it disappeared when Biden was inaugurated. And I think it was an online Munich security conference. Boris Johnson made a very clear decision. We know this because we've talked to the people who helped him write his speech. He made a very clear decision in that speech that he wasn't going to talk about the free trade deal for the first time. And it was so noticeable because it was the only thing he talked about. And suddenly, you know, he's talking about standing up alongside, you know, the United States and increasing defense spending of Britain and all the rest of it. And from that moment on, it's really not been talked about. We saw Liz Truss admitted publicly today that it wasn't on the agenda. That's got every headline in the United Kingdom today. You know, it's a confession and it's something that we all knew, but nobody is really saying exactly like that. She's made the point, but I think that Brits, you know, there's a sense in which not only Brits, but the British government blame that not really on Britain, they blame it on Congress. And so what you always hear in the UK is, well, of course, there's not going to be a US-UK free trade deal because Congress is deadlocked and America doesn't do free trade. You don't hear, we're not going to have one because they don't really want to work with us. That's not the storyline. That's not the headline that you generally hear in the UK.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Leslie Vingemiri, Director of the U.S. and the Americas Program at Chatham House. I encourage you to read her piece, How Brexit and Boris Broke Britain. You can find it at foreignaffairs.com. Leslie, thanks for joining us. A delight to chat.
Thank you, Jim. It's been great to speak with you.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. We love the feedback. As always, opinions expressed on the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Esther Fang with senior podcast producer Gabrielle Sierra. Marcus Zacharia and Esther Fang engineered this episode. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch and Michelle Carrilla for their assistance. This is the last episode that Margaret is assisting me on. Margaret, thank you very much for all your contributions to the President's Inbox. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.